the economic collapse that's coming will be much greater and more painful than what we experienced following the 08 financial crisis. If you have your money in a bank, you are going to lose.
Where are we now with the U.S. economy?
We're in a recession. I don't care what the statistics are showing, and they're very likely to be revised in the future to confirm that we're in a recession right now. I mean, that's what happened with the Great Recession, which started in December of 07. But for a year, the government gave out fake economic data. And then in December of 08, they came back and said, oh, by the way, we've been in a recession for an entire year. You can throw away all the data we gave you because it was wrong. And so they may do the same thing. We got factory orders came out today, biggest drop since we shut down during COVID. How can we be in a strong economy? If that's the case, you better bring an umbrella because you've got to trust your eyes, not the government. I'm not going to walk outside in the rain when I know it's raining just because some government weatherman is trying to convince me it's sunny. I think you can see it in the financial markets starting to happen. Gold just hit a new all-time record high today. What gold is telling you is that monetary policy is too loose, that the Fed needs to hike rates more. It hasn't hiked enough. Yet Powell is going to tell Congress that he's about to cut rates. Just a question of when. In fact, the whole market is trying to handicap how quickly the Fed's going to start cutting and how much he's going to cut. So the Fed is about to throw gasoline on an inflation fire that it lit. I think it's all politics, and I think the Fed stopped hiking for political reasons because it hasn't won the inflation war. In fact, it's already surrendered. Inflation is won. And if they cut rates before the election, it's politics. If they go back to quantitative easing, it's the same thing. They're also trying to prop everything up. They're trying to prop up the economy, prop up the stock market, prop up the banks, prop up the government. But the purpose is for political expediency. It's not good to prop up a phony economy. It's not good to prop up overpriced markets. It's not good to prop up insolvent banks. What's good is to let the market fix the problem. Let stock prices come down, let the economy restructure, let insolvent banks fail. That's actually healthy because then we could come out of it on the other side with a viable, strong economy instead of constantly trying to keep it together with inflation. And then eventually what happens is inflation becomes the main problem, and we're already really there. Inflation is the biggest economic problem, thanks to the Fed using inflation as the solution to all the other problems. And now that problem is about to get a whole lot worse.
When we look at 2007, the Fed dropped the rates and it didn't work. Will it work this time?
We had a small rate cuts. And then, of course, after the crisis, we went all the way down to zero. The problem isn't that rates are too high. It's that they're too low. And so reducing them further isn't going to solve anything. What we need to do is get to the root cause of the problem, which is excess government spending, excess government borrowing, and too much government interference in the economy through regulation. But none of this is being addressed. All we want to do is blow more air into every bubble. But I think what's going to happen is the realization that inflation is not going away, but that the Fed can't fight it anymore. Because if it fights it, the collateral damage will be too great. Everybody is insolvent based on the amount of debt that we have, thanks to how low interest rates were and how long the Fed kept them there. All of the crises were a byproduct of bad monetary policy. And monetary policy since the 08 financial crisis has been much worse. And therefore, the economic collapse that's coming will be much greater and more painful than what we experienced following the 08 financial crisis. I don't think we're focused on the economy at all. We're just focused on consumption and spending, and we think that's the economy. It's not. The economy is what we produce, not what we consume. The reason that we're able to consume so much more than we produce is because we're going into debt. And this is not sustainable because the debt is already too large.
Do you think we'll see another Great Depression?
It could be a greater depression. It could be worse than the Great Depression because of inflation. During the 1930s, consumer prices went down quite a bit, and that was a buffer. That was a benefit that helped offset the higher unemployment. But we have to remember that we only had a Great Depression because of government policy. The free market would not have produced a Great Depression. It was the Fed that got it started, then the Hoover and then Roosevelt administrations that prolonged it. We didn't end up getting out of the Depression until we ended the Second World War. So it started basically 1929 and we got out of it in 1946. It was a terrible economic period. And this time it's going to be worse because the government has made a lot more mistakes and is likely to make even bigger mistakes during the crisis than it made before. All the money that we created, most of it is still out there circulating. Not all the supply has come back online, but there's even more demand. There's been a huge expansion of credit. People are flush with cash from government handouts and bank lending to go out and bid up prices, and that's what's happening. You know, the big problem, too, wasn't just that we stopped the supply side by telling people not to work. We stoked the demand side by sending them checks to spend. In fact, many Americans got bigger checks from the government not to work than they earned on their jobs, despite the fact that they had zero productivity. It was a recipe for massive inflation, and now we're eating it. If you force employers to pay people $20 an hour, then if you're not that productive, you're legally unemployable. You can't get a job. The government prices people out of the labor market. And this is the worst time to be trying to force higher wages on employers who now have AI and automation and robotics that they can turn to. The government always creates these problems. During the Great Depression, the reason that unemployment was so high was because the government leaned on employers not to reduce wages, even as prices were collapsing. And they kept wages high, so they fired workers instead. Now, it would have been better if they just reduced wages and they could have kept people. But the wages wouldn't have really gone down in real terms because the cost of living was going down. And by not allowing wages to fall along with other prices, labor became too expensive, and so businesses had to cut back, and so they laid people off. You know, now trying to force businesses to overpay their workers, they're not going to do it. I mean, they'll overpay some if they have to, but at the expense of firing a lot of other people. So there are some lucky winners from the minimum wage, but more losers who end up losing their jobs. Now, you know, automation easier, there could be even more losers. And of course, the customers all lose because as a result of higher wage costs mandated by the government, prices are higher for everything that those workers are helping to produce or all the services that they are helping to provide. But again, the people who are hurt the most are the people who don't get jobs or the people who lose their jobs. And more importantly, they're denied the opportunity to climb up the job ladder because they can't improve their skills with on-the-job training because they don't get a job. And so they don't get the training. And so they're trapped in poverty indefinitely. And many of them may end up turning to crime, which has all sorts of other negative implications for society. None of the government numbers are honest. I mean, that's the one thing, they're consistent, right? They lie about everything. It's very difficult nowadays to be considered unemployed, even if you don't have a job. If you've been unemployed for over a year, they don't count you. You drop out of the statistics.
That's crazy.
You would think those people should count extra. But if I've been unemployed for 5 years and I still can't find a job, why aren't you counting me as unemployed? I'm really unemployed. Then, as long as you have any job while you're looking for a job, let's say I'm out there looking for a job every day, but for one day a week, I work part-time at McDonald's. Well, I'm not unemployed anymore. Or if I drive an Uber in my spare time while I'm looking for a job, well, I'm not unemployed anymore. So a lot of people that would have been counted as unemployed in the past, they're not counted anymore. So it's not that we have a low unemployment rate, we just don't keep track of it accurately. Same thing with inflation. Inflation is actually much higher than the government numbers would reveal because that's how they've been designed. They've been designed deliberately to underreport the rate at which prices are rising because they take those rising prices and they have all kinds of ways of adjusting them to make the rise smaller. And that also means that the GDP numbers are inflated. The economy is not growing nearly as fast as the government claims. In fact, I think the economy is shrinking at the same time the government claims it's growing. You have a record number of young adults that live with their parents now, all-time record. Most families haven't been able to survive on a single paycheck since the 1960s, because before the 1970s, and it really started in earnest during the 80s, but before then, if a woman got married, if she had a job, she quit. Married women did not work. In fact, if you were married and your wife worked, it was embarrassing for you. Most husbands would take a second job before they let their wife have a first job. And it didn't matter whether you were white collar, blue collar. Blue collar workers could still afford to support a stay-at-home wife, mother, and raise their kids. Maybe they had a smaller house and they didn't have as expensive cars or they didn't take as lavish a vacation, but they were able to afford to support their family, which included a wife who did not have to go to a job and get a paycheck. The inflation was so bad during the 1970s, the dollar lost so much value that husband's paycheck could no longer support the stay-at-home mother. And that's what began the influx of married women into the workforce. It wasn't women's liberation, right? That's what they want to tell us, that they got liberated. They didn't get liberated, they got unliberated. They were liberated when they didn't have to work. They could have chosen to work if they wanted to. Now women are forced to work. They got no choice. How is that liberation? But it was a lower standard of living. That's what happened. A man couldn't support his wife anymore. The wife had to get a job. That is a lower standard of living. Now what's happening is the husband and wife each have a job, and that's not enough. Now they need more jobs. Now they got to get a second job or a third job. The next thing that's going to happen is our young kids are going to have to drop out of school, and they're going to have to go to work too. That's how it all started before capitalism and the Industrial Revolution. People had kids because they needed the help on the farm. The family was working the land. But capitalism increased labor productivity that the father didn't need his kids doing work, didn't need his wife doing work. He could do it all himself. Well, we're going backwards. Now, hopefully, AI can help push against that trend by increasing labor productivity or reducing the need for labor in some cases altogether, because we have computers that can think. And you know, it's not just inflation, but it was tax increases. Taxes went up a lot during the 1970s, 1980s, even before Reagan. He had some cuts, but not enough to offset what happened in the 70s. More of your paycheck was taken away and sent to government, and so you had less available for yourself and your family. In fact, in many cases, when the wife got a job, she just earned what her husband paid in taxes. So the wife was working for the government, and the husband was working for the family. The government is constantly growing in size and imposing a greater burden on the population. At the same time, capitalism is trying to ease that burden by innovating. Capitalism is a force for good. Government is a force for bad. Capitalism creates abundance. Governments create scarcity. Capitalism increases production and increases quality and lowers cost. Government reduces quality and increases costs, right? So you want more freedom and less government. But unfortunately, we've been headed in the other direction. When it gets bad enough, look, hey, they're turning around in Argentina right now. What do you know? They got a free market libertarian as president, and he's cutting spending like crazy. He's eliminating departments. He's firing government workers. He's doing what needs to be done. If they could do it in Argentina after 100 years of mistakes and bad policy and impoverishing a once extremely wealthy nation, you know, maybe there's hope for us. All the countries are experiencing negative consequences of the same monetary and fiscal policy mistakes. We all made them, especially during COVID. But everybody had interest rates too low. In Europe and Japan, they were negative. I mean, they didn't even stop at zero. They went negative. And all these governments ran large deficits. So everybody is paying the price. And everybody made the same mistake, and everybody is suffering a similar consequence. I just think that America is uniquely positioned to suffer more because we have a lot more to lose. We have the reserve currency, and I think we're going to lose that. The U.S. is going to be in worse shape than Europe or Japan based on the loss of a privilege that neither of those economic zones enjoyed. Our economy, our prosperity was false going into this because it was built on a foundation of debt and the dollar's reserve status. We were able to sustain ourselves because we can afford to import record amounts of goods that we couldn't produce with the paper that we printed. But when the dollar crashes, we can't do that anymore. And the whole house of cards comes tumbling down.
America's economic sanctions are hurting its economy. Any thoughts on this?
In the short run, from a political perspective, it was a huge mistake, right? There's an old expression, you don't bite the hand that feeds you. We were being fed by nations that were holding on to dollars as their reserves. And then we punished Russia for doing what we wanted them to do, which was hold large US dollar reserves instead of spending those dollars and having them bid up US prices. And they invested those dollars in US treasuries. That helped sustain our deficits, and Americans didn't have to buy the treasuries because the Russians were doing it. Well, we punished the Russians for doing that. And when we did that, we sent a clear signal to the rest of the world, you could be next. If you do anything that the United States does not like, this is what's going to happen to you. What I would do if I was China, I was Saudi Arabia, I was India, I was anybody, I'd be like, oh, whoa, I'm not gonna let what happened to Russia happen to me. I get your message, I'm out of the dollar. I don't want them anymore. And that's the source of our power. That's the source of our standard of living, the dollar. The world is starting to divest themselves of dollars. Now, what are they buying with the dollars they're selling? Because in order to get out of the dollar, you have to get into something. They're getting into gold. That's what they've been buying. That's why gold's at an all-time record high today. That's why, despite the fact that individuals have been selling gold for months, gold's hitting a new all-time record high today because central banks are buying the gold to replace the dollar. And they are preparing for a new gold standard where gold is going to be the key monetary reserve asset, not US dollars. And that's what's happening. People haven't woken up. They're too busy, distracted by con game in crypto to notice what's happening with gold. But on a bigger scale, they're not noticing what this portends for the United States and for this phony prosperity that we've enjoyed because we've been able to export money that we print for the goods everybody else produces. It costs nothing to conjure money into existence. It takes a lot of resources to create goods, consumer goods. This is huge, what's going on. And people are just, you know, whistling past this graveyard. But I'm doing everything I can. I've been telling people they got to buy gold, they got to buy silver instead of cash. You know, we're record highs. Silver is still less than half of its record high. So silver is really a bargain. Gold's still cheap, but silver is dirt cheap. You don't think these guys know what they're doing? They're in control of the money. What are they doing? They're buying gold. They know what's coming. The public is clueless. You know, if you look at the ETF GLD, 9 weeks of consecutive outflows, a record, as gold keeps making new highs, and now it's at an all-time record high. Normally, the public doesn't do that. The public buys high and sells low. Normally, if gold was making a high, the public would be buying, not selling. They've been selling. That's the dumb money. The smart money is buying as much gold as they can get their hands on. And the media is distracting the public with fool's gold, talking about all these Bitcoin ETFs. A lot of people probably sold gold stocks to buy the Bitcoin ETFs. I was taking advantage of that. I was putting more of my own money into gold stocks. The gold price is not just some other commodity. If gold is really going up, that is the canary in the coal mine. You better get the hell out of that mine because something bad is going to happen. And the Fed is, of course, ignoring all these warning signs, and most investors are too. But the question is, will the markets see through the smokescreen and realize that these are not loans, that this is permanent debt monetization, that America is a banana republic, just without the bananas? That's bad for the dollar. And again, that's why the dollar's going down. It's why the price of gold's going up. Thanks to the government's policy since the 08 financial crisis, the entire banking industry is insolvent. It needs the support of the government to stay afloat. But the government can only support the banks if it sucks the wealth from the people by creating inflation. So it's a house of cards built on a house of cards. And you know, it's in the process, I think, of imploding. And we're gonna suffer. If you have your money in a bank, you are going to lose. Either your bank is going to fail and you're not gonna get your money out of it, or your bank fails and you get your money. But if you get your money, it's not gonna buy you very much because the government's gonna have to print it in order for you to get it. It's either you lose your money or your money loses its value. But either way, you lose, which is why I'm telling people, get your money out of the bank while you can and do something with it. Convert it into something real. Like those foreign central banks, what are they doing with their dollars? They're converting them into gold. So you could do that too, but you could also build a bigger portfolio that includes income producing assets, you know, whether it's income producing real estate or dividend paying stocks. You got to buy real things because at the end of the day, that's all that's left when you have hyperinflation. The paper claims to wealth disappear, but what's left is the actual stuff. In real terms, housing prices are gonna go down quite a bit in the US, but in nominal terms, it's hard to say. It's gonna be depending on a lot of factors that are local to that particular property and market. The big thing that housing prices have going for it is the lack of inventory to sell, because everybody who owns a house and has a mortgage, they ain't selling. You know, they got a mortgage with a two handle or a three handle. They can't go anywhere. Everything has gotten more expensive except their mortgage. It's one thing they have that hasn't gone up. And so they're staying there. And that means there's no homes for sale. And it's hard to build homes because it's very expensive. Raw materials, the labor. Now there's gonna be more houses on the market. People are gonna start to lose their jobs. People are gonna die. People are going to have reasons that homes are gonna come up for sale. And so over time, there'll be some more inventory. Inflation is going to continue to drive up the replacement cost. And so that's going to keep down building. It's going to make it more expensive to build. And it's going to allow landlords to raise their rent. So it's the income producing real estate, maybe multifamily stuff that lends itself to tenants and rentals. That's where you might have the most upside. And you'll be able to keep raising your rents. You just got to make sure you do it in a landlord friendly state. You don't want to do it in one of these states where your tenants could just stop paying you and you can't evict them. But I think inflation is going to be driving mortgage rates higher. We could see rates in the double digits. There's a real risk there. And if the Fed goes back to buying mortgages, then inflation is going to go even higher. The credit is going to dry up if rates aren't allowed to rise to a level that would compensate the lender for what they're losing to inflation. But look, you know, this is a disaster that the government has created, and it will blame it on everybody else and not accept responsibility. But it is one of the few things that's made in America is going to be this crisis, this financial, economic, currency, debt crisis. And it's going to be worse than anything we've lived through in either the Great Recession or the COVID times.
Hi, Ed. Thank you very much for joining us today. How are things in Hawaii?
They're recovering from the fires, unfortunately. But it's business as usual, which is good. The economy is slightly coming back here after the devastating fires. But, the one thing we're concerned with is the federal government aid isn't all that great, and people are struggling to rebuild, and it's a slow process. So unfortunately, disaster capitalism seems to be rearing its ugly head, meaning the typical developers are going to come in and try to scoop up land from people who need money.
And Ed, how is the tourism business? Is it coming back?
It came back a couple months after the fires, but it's starting to slow again. I have friends that have small businesses, and they're indicating that things are not good right now.
And I have to ask you, Hawaii has many beautiful islands, but what's your favorite island?
The one I live on, Maui.
It's been a few years since I was in Hawaii, but I remember Kauai. I spent a few days there and I was just blown away by the raw natural beauty of it.
Yeah, Kauai is beautiful, and it's breathtaking, but it's a lower populated island. And personally, I like living on Maui. There's more of a cultural center. Kauai is beautiful, but a little more isolated.
So I am based in Toronto and I always complain about the cost of living here. What's the cost of living like in Hawaii or on
Well,
Maui?
the cost of living is always been high in Hawaii. What's interesting is I used to think gas on Hawaii was expensive. It's running around four. Well, at Costco, it's at $4. At the other gas stations, it's at 480. And then my friends in California, in LA, are paying up to $6, $7 a gallon. So I feel blessed in many ways.
Well, that's incredible. So let's move on now. I want to have a discussion with you on the economy. And you and your team have written a lot about the money supply. And I want to start right here. Why don't you take us through your thesis of the money supply and what it means to the US economy?
Yeah, so go back to 2020. We were what people may or may not remember in 2019, the global economy was starting to slow, and there was a lot of indications that there might be a credit event because the Federal Reserve overnight window was going haywire in September. But then miraculously, COVID came along and provided an excuse to print unprecedented amounts of money. So COVID, when you look at the spending on COVID, here's a little statistic. From 2009, the financial crisis, to 2019, we grew the federal deficit by 11 trillion, so about a 1.2 trillion a year. And then after COVID hit in 2020, we've spent 8+ trillion. It's growing, yeah, maybe up to nine now. I did this as of like, towards the end of 23. So let's call it 9 trillion. That's about 2.5 trillion a year added to the deficit. And so COVID was a war, but it's warlike spending. And wars tend to be inflationary and reinflate the complex. And one of the bankers of the world have a saying, inflate or die. Deflation obviously is very bad for bankers. So we had an inflationary event occur in 2020 when the Federal Reserve printed 65% more money supply than the previous year, the highest increase in the money supply ever. And money supply and policy moves like that don't happen immediately in the economy. They take some time to ripple through, usually 1 to 2 years, let's call it 18 months. And so 18 months later, in 21, we started to see inflation, and that's when inflation took off. Then the Fed went on in 2022, they went on their unprecedented rate hike cycle. And we got to remember, we had zero interest rates for 14 years, basically, with an attempt at raising rates in 2017. That increase in interest rates that fast caused the money supply year-over-year growth. So money supplies took off after the COVID spending, and that's what the year-over-year growth went like this, and then it plummeted when they started tightening, and it went a negative year-over-year growth for the first time since 1930. And historically, when you go back into the historical record, that's usually then followed by economic contractions and bank failures. What was interesting was when the money supply went negative in November of 2022, like I said, there's a lag on money supply policy moves. So really, the crux of the money supply contraction is going to start hitting the economy in full force probably this May. And that's 18 months from November of 2022. What was interesting was we saw bank failures in March of last year, if you remember. They were quite scary. Silicon Valley Bank went bye-bye. First Republic went bye-bye. There were a couple, one or two others. And what was alarming about that was the speed with which they just disappeared. And they were some of the biggest bank failures we've ever seen. At the time, I did some interviews And I said, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury are going to try to either slow, they want to control the implosion. So, and they did a good job. I thought it could go two ways. Either they lose control or they control it. And they did. The Bank Term Funding Program kind of put a finger in the dike, but that program ended March 11th of this year. And we see New York Community Bank, hitting new lows in its stock price. They ran into trouble. So I think there's going to be regional bank consolidation and bank failures going forward. So that's going to be a problem because that's less credit in the economy. Money supply going negative is going to be less credit in the economy, and less credit means less economic activity. This should have caused a decline in the financial markets, but it didn't. And the reason is that the government stepped in at the Treasury, and that we're seeing unprecedented government spending that's really kind of given these quote-unquote good GDP numbers. So if you break down what's going on in GDP and in employment, mostly government jobs, and what do we know about a government job? It's not pro it's, there's no productivity associated with it. So this is, in fact, it might be, you could argue it's negative productivity. So in the short term, it provides a stimulus. In the long term, it's going to reverberate back into a less productive economy. So where we sit right now is we have money supply really going to start affecting the economy this May, we think. We think our economic cycle indicators are still in recessionary levels. That hasn't occurred in the numbers yet. But what's interesting is they went down, hit a low last year, and they started to rise, but they petered out. And we've seen this before in our economic models. There's a kind of a dead cat bounce. We think we're there. And the Federal Reserve is also, it's an election year, and the Federal Reserve is doing a quiet, stealth QT taper, quantitative. So they're tapering without really talking about it, and then they're talking about tapering later, but they're doing it right now, actually. It's kind of their quantitative tightening is less and less every month if you look at the numbers. So it's an election year. They're spending like crazy. They're going to try to hold this thing through November.
So let's just summarize all of that. So when you talk about the money supply, the money and the components of the money supply, that's the fuel to drive the economy. When there's a lot of money in the system, I'm jumping on a plane, I'm flying to Las Vegas, I'm going to see U2, and I'm spending $25 for a drink. And so I'm helping to stimulate the economy. Conversely, when there's a contraction within the money supply, there's less money in the system, and I'm not jumping on a plane and flying to Las Vegas or some other place.
Yeah,
Those are kind of.
it has knock-on effects, but it starts with the banking system. So the banks make less loans, loan standards are tightening, and that just slowly reverberates throughout the economy. And usually small businesses get hit first. Corporations don't tend to have a problem because they can issue debt or equity in the capital markets. But there's a lot of zombie companies out there right now. And right now, credit spreads are tight. We expect those to start widening sometime late summer, early fall, at which point we think that's when the reality in the financial markets hooks up with the reality in the real economy. So, as crazy as this may sound, the stock market is at all-time highs. It's probably going to have a little correction scare soon. Then it'll rally to a new high in the summer, when we look at it technically. And then from there, things get very interesting. The stock market went down a lot in 22. Then it had a tremendous rally since October of 2022, and it really took off at the end of 23. But the makeup of that market is different than the rally into the top in 22. The rally in 22 was most, all stocks kind of participated. You've heard of what everyone's talking about, the Magnificent Seven. So this is a really bifurcated market, and it's being held up by these mega cap stocks, and that usually can't sustain itself. And it's risk reward here is very, very bad. And if you have a longer, if you're a trader, good luck to you. But if you're like a long-term investor and you have a 5 to 10 year time frame, risk here is quite high.
And I want to ask you one more question about the money supply. When you talk about the contraction in the money supply and the current situation we find ourselves in, when was the last time, or how does this time compare to other cycles?
Well, the money supply started coming down before it went year over year growth negative. So it peaked earlier in 2022, and then started coming way down when the rate hikes started. It went negative in November of 2022, year over year growth, and that's the first time since 1930. And we looked historically. I have a friend, Tim Wood. He's a cycles analysis. He's got his own work. You can go look at cyclesman.com. But he went back all the way to the 1800s. And every time money supply went year over year growth negative, it was associated with a banking crisis of some kind.
And remind me again, what's the lag effect associated with the money supply or contraction?
18 months. So there was an 18-month lag on inflation from the 2020 spending, and then there'll be an 18-month, we think around an 18-month lag with the contraction, which can it honestly it could hit any time between now and summer. But we suspect, given what the Federal Reserve is doing and the Treasury is doing with their fiscal irresponsibility, they'll be able to kind of hold it up a little longer, but not much longer.
So you made mention of how strong the economy is, and it's growing at 5% annualized, give or take. We've also had 25 consecutive quarters of unemployment below 4%. The last time we saw that was in 1969. You made mention of the fact that the stock market is trading at all-time highs, and numerous stocks. Of course, I got to talk about Nvidia, but I think it's up 80% on the year. Bitcoin is up 50% on the year, so it's definitely risk on, but if I was to take the other side of your argument, it looks to me, it looks like everything's great. What am I missing?
Well, yeah, everything's great except the real economy. The real economy isn't doing well. The unemployment numbers are, we think, at this point, getting to the point of fraudulent. If you look at what happened in 2023, every payroll number they reported, they revised down. So, and to the tune of 1.5 million jobs for the full year 2023. And most of the jobs that are being reported are government jobs and or part-time jobs. They call it the gig economy. And what do we know about that? We know that low-paying jobs, and if you need three of them just to make basic needs, that's not a growth model.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I might have to be taking one of those gig jobs.
Yeah, I agree.
So you also touched on the debt levels in the US, and right now the federal debt is around $35 trillion, and it's actually growing by, I believe it's $1 trillion every 100 days. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Like it's just mind-blowing what's happening. But so let's talk a little bit more about the debt. And listen, we've both heard about the debt levels for decades now, and yet the economy continues to push ahead, and it really has no long-term impact, or so it seems, but you think otherwise.
Yeah, so let's look at the numbers. So when the Great Financial Crisis happened, I think we were at 60% debt to GDP ratio. We're at 120% now. In addition, during the Great Financial Crisis, if you look at all public debt, state and local at the end of the financial crisis, 2009, was 30%. And since then, that ratio and the government was 70%, the federal government. Since then, that ratio has gone to 90% federal, 10% state and local. Why did that occur? Well, I don't, it is a little history lesson, but there was a lot of concerns after the Great Financial Crisis that states and municipalities and counties would go bankrupt. Well, the federal government has been subsidizing their budgets. So, if you look at the budgets, most of the states get an injection from the feds. That's also caused kind of a centralization of power. So the states' governors, you know, when they, especially in Texas and Florida, when they talk a big game, they still are beholden to the feds for a lot of their budget. So the federal balance sheet has been subsidizing state and local, and now we're at 120%. And at some point that becomes unsustainable. And I would say that growing the deficit $1 trillion every 100 days, we're getting close. We're getting close. So something's got to give, and it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, it's truly remarkable. Like, if you and I are talking in a year from now, where's the debt level going to be?
Well, let's see. A year, another $3 trillion, so 37, 38.
Yeah, what's another $1 trillion? So let's talk a little bit more about the regional banking system. You touched on that in Silicon Valley Bank, and I would agree with you. It's amazing how fast the feds were able to contain that so it didn't spread. But now we have this issue with the New York Community Bank. And I guess my question to you is, do you think there's more coming?
Yeah, there's definitely more coming, because there's two things going on with the bank, with those banks. We call them the regional banks. And they, for 14 years, were paying zero on their deposits, and that's the liability side of the balance sheet. And their assets were loans and treasuries and, you know, corporate bonds if they bought them for their portfolio to make the spread. But banking is nothing more than borrowing short, lending long, and you make an interest rate spread, because most of the time the interest rate curve is positively sloped. Well, when the Fed went off on its unprecedented rate hiking cycle, people started to notice, and so they had all these bonds in their portfolio, some of which were just simple, safe treasuries, and those went down 30% in price. When you go from zero to, you know, treasury bonds, safe bonds, so that they went down in price. So their mark to market was, now this is mark to market held to maturity, so they weren't bankrupt right away, but on the liability side, the deposit side, they couldn't raise the deposit rate that they paid to their savers fast enough, because they didn't have the app, so they would have started losing money had they matched the Federal Reserve's new rate of eventually 5.5%. So what happened in March of 2023, and it started happening prior to that, people were starting to figure out, well, I got $50,000 in my savings account earning zero. I can go buy a 3-month T-bill for 4%, 5%. So it's called a disintermediation of the regional banking system. So their deposits started to go. So what the Fed did when that became apparent was they made loans to these banks, but the deposits are still continuing to flow out, because the current interest rate on a money market fund or a US T-bill is 5.5%, and they have not raised they're not competitive in the marketplace. So that's number one. They're losing their borrowing short, lending long. So they're losing their liability. Their deposits are flying. Now we're coming into an economic contraction, and credit will start to sour. That's already started in the commercial real estate market, and a lot of these regional banks have commercial real estate exposure. So as time rolls, they have two problems, deposit flight and credit problems. So that's why I expect to see more problems in the regional banking system. And I suspect we'll see some shotgun marriages between those banks and the big money center banks over the course of the next 2 years. And it depends. It may not happen for a couple more months this year. We might not, New York Community Bank may get sold to somebody, but, you know, I just know in the next 2 years, we're going to see some sort of movement on that. And, you know, quite honestly, at the time the Silicon Valley Bank and the other ones failed, I said, this is exactly, if you wanted to issue a central bank digital currency, it'd be easier to do it with only six major banks in the US rather than the current number, which is hundreds. So it's a lot easier to do a CBDC if you don't have a bunch of banks.
And I want to have a discussion with you on that. But before we do that, let's just summarize a lot of the points that you've just made. So first of all, in spite of the fact that the economy is growing at 5%, that the S&P and the NASDAQ are trading at or near all-time highs, you think we're in for some trouble and in both the economy and also the stock markets. So maybe you can just expand on that. And what will be the catalyst to take everything down?
Well, typically, so we got an election in November. There's going to be a lot of uncertainty associated around that. And markets top when there's a lack of buyers. So this we're in a kind of a bubble in seven stocks. NVIDIA is up 80%. It's got its market valuation is the same as all of the Chinese stock market. So, you know, what do we know about bubbles? When they burst fast and quick. NVIDIA is being pumped up because of the excitement about AI. And what do I know about semiconductor companies? They're cyclical. So at some point, it's going to be valued like a cyclical company. And that again, that's why I think the stock market probably peaks late summer. So you really don't need a catalyst. It's just, and again, the contraction from the money supply will be hitting. So liquidity will start drying up. So really, if you're playing the trading game here, good. I mean, you know, day trader, you know what you're doing. But if you're a long-term investor and you're putting new money to work today, I think you're not going to be happy in 2 to 3 years.
And what sort of pullback are you looking at in both the economy and also in the S&P?
Well, it's hard to gauge that because one of the problems right now is that the stock market is actually one of the biggest assets to the Fed and the U.S. government, in that it creates the only thing we have left right now. We have no manufacturing jobs, we have government spending, and we have the wealth effect from the stock market. And so the stock market needs to be saved at all costs. So it depends on what we see from the response from the Federal Reserve once the contraction happens. So, you know, I'm thinking anywhere from a 30 to 50% drawdown, and then they'll try to save it. If it goes below 50, that means they've lost control, because traditionally they've been able to save it at a 50%. We had a 50% drawdown in 2000, 50% drawdown in 2009. Anything more than that, then we have what we call Great Depression type retrace, where you retrace 90%, 80% of all the gains. So I can't tell you, like, until I see what the Fed and the government does, but they'll do something. And I think that's when they introduce the CBDC.
Okay, so let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, look, the CBDC is for me personally, I think I'm against it because I know the abuse of power that can be made with it. Basically, you can link it to everything. So you can start to impose social controls on people. You can debank people and turn off their bank account if you want to. So it's kind of a modern day slavery system. And if they wanted to, you know, if somebody got into office and said, and was a vegan and said, we're going to impose meat quotas, technologically, they'd be able to prevent you from buying more meat at the grocery store, meaning the clerk couldn't even transact for you. It's that kind of control. And that kind of control, we always know will be abused. So I love cash. I've been to protest. I spend cash as much as I can in all restaurants. And when I go out shopping, I pay in cash.
Well, we've actually had a situation here in Canada, of all places, if you can believe it, but where the government actually did that very thing against the trucker convoy. I believe that was 2 years ago, but I'm sure you read about that.
Yeah, no. So that was a beta test. And what they didn't count on was the moment they did that, the blowback was huge. And there was an immediate fear in the financial markets, where if you were outside of Canada and you had money in Canada, you said, I want my money back. So there was actually a drawdown in the banks figured that out pretty quick. They started seeing fast movement, and I think they went to the Trudeau folks and said, "You guys, no."
Yeah, it's hard to believe in all countries in the world. I would never, never did I ever think that would happen in Canada. But they, don't they have central bank digital currencies in China?
You know, I don't know if they do yet. I think they're testing them. But they have other methods of control. I mean, they have social credit scores. So, you know, they have an AI system where if you go online and you say bad things about the government, you can't get an airplane ticket. You can't. So I don't think it's a CBDC. It's more just a monitoring system that is pretty Orwellian, so to speak.
And the whole motive or objective behind implementing central bank digital currencies is just to control the population. Is that right?
Well, I think ultimately that's the people who are pushing this. That's what they want. I think there are a lot of players in it that don't. They think it's great and it's convenient, and I think they're just naive. You know, we've seen there's a famous clip of a Bank of International Settlements banker speaking about how you can control many things with the CBDC, and he basically revealed the plot.
And how
he
do
said we can control how people spend their money. I mean, he said it.
And how do cryptocurrencies fit into this whole thesis?
Well, cryptocurrency. I mean, I'm not a Bitcoin or crypto expert because I'm 56. I kind of miss that. But I think they're legitimate alternatives. My only fear would be if there was a solar flare. Like in the 1800s, the Carrington effect, and we lost all of our electricity. What's Bitcoin worth with no electricity? So that's like a black swan event. So you can't worry about that. But I do think cryptocurrencies are legitimate, especially Bitcoin. There's a lot of speculation and fraud in the crypto world. We've seen, you know, fraud in the crypto world. So like any new market, it's the Wild West. But I think cryptocurrencies are around to stay because people view them as an alternative to run amok central banks and government spending.
Ed, you have written in the past that a Trump-Biden rematch would be the worst possible outcome, and it looks like we're going to have that. Why did you say that?
Well, because the choices between. So Trump will be a lame duck president. So he's already served one term. So he'll get in there and he'll be a lame duck president right away. Biden is, you know, corrupt and old and a puppet, in my humble opinion. And we're going to see come this fall a strategy by the Democrats to remove Trump from the ballot and or put him in jail. And that's going to cause a lot of societal angst and anger. And the two camps are completely living in different realities. And, you know, I'm not going to argue which one's more real, has a better grip on reality. But when you have that kind of polarization where people look at the other people as the others, it's a toxic brew. So I think we're going to see things we've never seen come this fall. And I do think as we get closer to the election, the capital markets will start to become very nervous because the rule of law will come in here. There'll be a lot of chaos, a lot of protests, it's going to be bad. It's not good.
It's going to be interesting times, that is for sure. And then when we look out into 2025, especially when it comes to the economy and the financial markets, what do you think happens?
Well, so like I said, I think stock markets kind of peak out this summer. It can be a 2000-2001 kind of decline where it takes 2 years to go down 50%, or it can be fast. I don't know. But what I do know is if Trump wins, you know, then they're going to lay this recession at his feet. If Biden wins, they'll try to hold it up, but I don't think they'll be able to hold it up for very long. So we're looking at end of 24, beginning of 25 as a very turbulent time. And again, because of the money supply going down in November of 22 and still down there, this could happen at any time. So like, I could be wrong. This, you know, we could blow up now, and there's black swan events out there that could derail this. Like the Bank of Japan is having problems. There's currency issues with the yen right now, and the yen carry trade has been a big funder of global financial assets for a long, long time. And the yen is flirting with a technical level that's very scary to the Bank of Japan. The U.S. dollar Japan trade is valued at 151 right now, and if it breaks out much higher than this level, that could cause some turbulence. So Japan is faced with a difficult choice. They need to either keep rates low or raise rates to stave off inflation. And you know, do they save the global economy or do they save their own economy? And that's something the Federal Reserve can't control. Right now, there's been a lot of central bank coordination, but at some point, this global debt problem we've had gets the release valve always has been currencies. So if we have a currency crisis in a major Western, not Western, but major economy like Japan, it'll have knock-on effects throughout the global financial system. So that can occur at any moment.
And let me just expand on that a little bit, okay? So you're saying the U.S. or the carry trade that everybody was doing in Japan, they were basically borrowing money in Japan and then investing it elsewhere throughout the world?
Yeah, correct. I mean, Japan has been zero forever, and the yen has been pretty stable. But the problem has been since COVID, Japan has printed way more money than anybody, and their own Bank of Japan's assets are at the same level as their GDP, annual GDP growth every year. So that's a ratio. The U.S. is at 25%. So our Federal Reserve's balance sheet is at 25% of our annual GDP. Japan's ratio is 1-to-1.
So if they do start increasing interest rates,
the point is the yen needs to devalue, and they're trying to prevent that. But at some point, the market's going to figure out the yen needs to go a lot lower and devalue. And that'll blow up the yen carry trade, and that'll be a giant global margin call. But again, that I can't predict when that's going to happen.
Fascinating. Ed, as we wrap up, you have painted a picture of a very negative picture with the economy and the U.S. markets. And if there was one thing that might derail your whole thesis and where we see the market continue to go higher, what would it be?
What would it be? Well, if Biden decided to reverse all his economic policies, if he unleashed the energy complex and drove the price of oil way down, if he started to do what Trump was trying to do, bring manufacturing jobs back. I mean, if he could reverse his policies, that could be something I don't see, but I don't think he's going to do that. And then a Trump victory could give a lot of optimism, but I do think that there's so much pent up dislocations in the global financial system that I think Trump will have difficulty his second term. So there'd have to be any kind of reversal of policy would blow up my thesis. And you know, I want to say something about interest rate cuts. So the Fed is on pause. And people need to understand something about what happened in 2000 and 2007, 8, before the downturn of the financial markets. The Federal Reserve had been in a policy of hiking interest rates to cool the economy. They then paused. Then they started cutting. cuts are generally viewed as bullish, but not when you're going into a recession. They're very bearish. So the Federal Reserve, I think, is pausing because they're seeing what's going on in the credit complex, but they're not talking about it. And if you see short-term interest rates start to really go down quickly, that's a sign of bad things coming.
Well, that was a fascinating discussion, and it sounds like the back half of 2024 is going to be an interesting one, to say the least. And I want to thank you for making time with us today, and I look forward to our next discussion.
Thank you, James. Good to be here.